These lakes hold a lot of stories, and all of them get better every time they're told. Because you've got 40-inch gators out there, giant lakers, crappies, sunnies, and walleye. So many walleye. So get ready with the best from clam, otter, vexlar, hummingbird, garmin, 13 fishing, and many more. The Shields Ice Fishing Sale runs now through December 13th, in-store and online at shields.com. The ice is calling.
Hello and welcome to the Reverend Hunter Podcast. This is Tony Jones, the Reverend Hunter, joined for this special fifth Monday episode by my trustworthy companion, Brandon. Brandon, how you doing?
I'm doing well, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Good.
I'm doing great. I've been getting a lot of comments from people saying, man, you're having the greatest hunting season. And I think it's because of Instagram, partly, but also I am having a great hunting season.
Good.
Like I'm very fortunate. Since we last talked, we had our deer firearm season. I mean, I guess I mentioned it on the intro of our last podcast episode with our London-based Italian chef, James. But I shot two big-bodied, beautiful deer on the same day, which I've never done before, on opener of firearm season here in Minnesota. I was in a tree stand on the very north edge of our property when a doe came running toward me. And I used some guy's grunt to get a white-tailed deer to stop in its tracks. But I used a little Cesar Millan. Have you ever watched Cesar Millan, the dog whisperer on TV?
I have watched one of my favorite episodes of South Park is parodying him, actually. But yeah,
okay, that's awesome.
Yeah, he makes that noise or whatever.
Yeah, he goes, tss.
Yeah.
So I did that, man. This doe was just like running toward me, and I went, tss, and it stopped in its tracks, and I shot it, and it dropped. And man, this deer was so big, I could not lift it in the back of the truck. I tried for about half an hour to get it onto the tailgate of my truck, couldn't do it. So finally, I attached ratchet straps to the front and rear of the deer and like ratcheted it up enough that I could kind of heave it into the back. I didn't want to call, like everybody else who was up there at our place with us, they were all hunting, and I didn't want to, you know, it was like we had just started hunting an hour before, and I didn't want to bother any of them and get them down from their stands and mess up their hunt. So I wasn't going to call anybody for help. And yeah, so I finally got it back to the cabin, got it hung up, got it skinned, and then I thought, well, I'm gonna, you know, go sit again, because in our you've been to our place, it's in a CWD management zone, so that means you can take a buck, and then you can take up to five does. That's per person. Wow. And the doe tags cost $2.50.
So why wouldn't you go back out?
Yeah, exactly. So I'd shot the doe, and I still had a tag for a buck, and I went out and sat in another ladder stand on another part of our property. And about half an hour, I suppose, before sunset, I saw a buck. It was the furthest shot, furthest or farthest? That's one I'm not so great at.
I will say
the furthest shot I've ever taken. I'm guessing it was 110 yards, probably between some trees. And I took a shot, and I broke the deer's front leg. And I climbed down out of the stand, and you know, it was kind of limping, and it was wounded, and I had to take another shot. It was, and that deer took a while to die. And so it's actually one of the things I've been thinking about this hunting season is I've been thinking about death and thinking about when an animal dies at my hand. And, you know, we've talked about this before on the podcast. I talked about it particularly a couple episodes ago with Jill Carroll. I strongly urge people to go back and listen to that episode if they haven't. But man, it's, I don't know, it's something. Have you seen, has anybody died in front of you?
I've put animals, you know, to sleep and such like that, like, you know, mm-hmm. personal pets and stuff, but nothing else really of any extreme nature, no.
Yeah, no humans have died in front of you? And
Nope, I've been fortunate in that regard.
Yeah, I've had a few. I mean, when I was a pastor, of course, that does happen that you're by people's bedside when they die on occasion.
Right.
And so I had that experience. I was in the room when my dad died about 2.5 years ago. I will tell you this. I mean, it's hard to, I'm obviously stammering for words because it's hard to articulate, I think. But here's one thing I did walk away from this deer season thinking. Two things, I guess, I'd say. One is I never want to get inured to the pathos of death and the suffering that I put, you know, an animal through when I shoot it. I don't want to become insulated, or, you know, I don't want to forget that, or I don't want to become insensitive to what that means. I hope that when an animal dies in front of me, it affects me, because it's a, you know, it's there's a finality to it, obviously, to bring the end to, the end of life to another creature. But here's the other thing, is that, you know, I shoot one or two deer a year. I shoot dozens of ducks and pheasants a year, and this is one of the things I've been thinking about too, is it is hard to stay attuned to the finality of the death when, you know, you're shooting pheasants, you know, two or three a day for 3 or 4 or 5 days straight, which is often how my pheasant hunting trips go. Or the same with ducks, you know, you can shoot 7 a day most places. So yeah, that's something I've been thinking about, is just the death, you know, I've said it before that all of us who eat meat, whether you're a hunter or not, you're implicated in the death of an animal. But I'm, you know, immediately implicated in it because I'm causing the death at my hand. I'm not outsourcing that death to another human being. So anyway, that's been something. Thought I'd start off our little fifth Monday episode with something light and happy. What do you think about that?
No, I mean, it's interesting you bring it up. Me, you know, just dipping my toes into the hunting world, obviously that's one thing that weighs on my mind, is how I'm going to feel afterwards. And, you know, as you kind of put it, you know, with the multiple ducks or multiple pheasants in a day, I guess I'm kind of, you know, do you feel different when it's the birds versus the mammals? I mean, I'm kind of asking an obvious question, but do you get a little bit colder now that, you know, you do so many birds in a day where, you know, you still feel the death, but emotionally you're just not tied to it. Whereas a deer is, you know, one, maybe two or whatever a season, that feeling holds stronger to you. Is there a big difference in the two, like when you're hunting?
Yeah, there's a huge difference. There's a huge difference. And I remember when you and I started talking about your, you know, initial forays into hunting, and you said, well, I think I could shoot a squirrel or a pheasant. I don't think I could shoot a deer. And it is different to shoot. It's different to shoot an animal with eyelashes.
Right.
You know, right. I mean, it's not the eyelashes exactly, but.
But I mean, it's also the pure physical size of it too. Yeah. And you know, when you see the inside of an animal that big, you know, it's a little different off than us, but you could see like the heart physically looks like a heart, or the lungs physically look like what you would see almost, you know, lungs looking like for a human. Again, I understand they're not the same. The sizes are different, but it's just more of a comparable or more of a relatable.
They're pretty close, man. I mean, I remember the first time that I gutted a deer and I put my hands into its, you know, viscera and started pulling it out. You kind of separate all the internal organs from the chest cavity, and then you start pulling bits out. And I did, that's exactly what I thought, Brandon. I thought, man, like, this heart is about the same size as a human heart, this stomach, these intestines, the, you know, these kidneys, like everything's about the same size as if you were putting your hands into the body cavity of a human being, and same, you know, generally same temperature. And it's very different when you are, you know, gutting a pheasant that you shot 2 days earlier and has been hanging outdoors in the cool air. And, you know, you put two fingers in there and scoop it out. It still takes a little getting used to, but you get used to it a lot faster, I think, than the deer hunting. So yeah, I mean, I sympathize with you when you say that you'd be down with, you know, shooting a squirrel or a bird, but it would be, it's a bigger leap to shoot a pheasant, and I mean to shoot a deer. And I, you know, I spent many years hunting birds before I started deer hunting, for some of those same reasons that you bring up.
Now, when you get a deer, and I know there's other large game out there, does it inspire you to find that other big game hunt out there, such as, you know, an elk, caribou, whatever? Does it get you more excited, or does it kind of make you take a step back and go, wow, this really is a big thing that I'm doing, or, you know, a bigger life that I'm taking, quote unquote?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think it dissuades me from doing those other kinds of hunts.
Okay.
But I'll tell you what, it does make me think a couple things. For one thing, like, to shoot that buck and just break its front leg and then have to, you know, kind of find it and shoot it again in order to kill it. It did make me think, like, I've never had the misfortune of losing an animal. I mean, I've lost plenty of birds that, you know, I haven't been able to find or have wounded and they've gotten away, but I have never shot a deer that I couldn't find. Here's a crazy thing too, man. When I was cleaning that, when I was like butchering the meat on that deer, the back strap is, it's a muscle that runs on either side of the spine on the back side of a deer, on the outside. The tenderloins are on the inside, and then the back strap runs down either side of the spinal column on the back. There was a broadhead, like an arrow head, a broadhead in the back strap of the buck that I shot.
Jeez.
So somebody had shot that deer with an arrow probably a year ago, I'm guessing. I don't think it was this year. I think it was a year ago. And the deer survived, and muscle had grown all around, muscle and viscera and all sorts of other stuff had grown all around that broadhead. So think about that, man. Somebody shot that deer. It survived for another, you know, year, and then I shot it with a rifle and harvested it. But you think about that. That was kind of took my breath away a little bit. And I know, you know, that's not that rare of an occurrence that people find, you know, arrowheads or what, arrow shafts, or they find deer that have had been hit by cars and survived and have, like, you know, scar tissue and stuff like that. Now, but here's what I did think. I thought, first of all, one thing was it was unseasonably warm this year in Minnesota for deer opener on whatever, November 5th or whatever it was. It was like 70 degrees. So we usually have this really great luxury of hanging our deer. Last year, I hung my deer for a week outdoors because it was the perfect kind of dry aging weather. You know, it was like 35 every day, got down to 25 at night. It's great for the meat. We had to hustle to get that meat butchered and on ice this year. And that's just the way it is in a lot of places. So one thing I thought, I mean, so the two things I guess I thought about chasing other big game was if I'm going to do it somewhere that's warmer, that has a warmer climate, I really need to be prepared to butcher that deer quickly and efficiently so as not to lose any meat. Because it's really important to me that if I'm going to take the life of an animal, that I use all the meat off that animal. And the second thing was just that to make sure that I really make a good shot. I mean, it's one thing to you know, break this deer's leg in the woods. I was able to get down out of my ladder stand, get to within close, you know, 25 yards of the deer and shoot it again with a double lung shot, which, you know, killed it almost instantly. It would be much tougher, you know, out west in the open prairie or whatever, shoot an animal, make a not a great shot, and that animal could just absolutely boogie. And I mean, that can happen with white-tailed deer too, but I think it's probably much more likely in the open ground. So I did, after my conversation with Michael Chan, which we released on October 5th, we recorded that in my backyard, as you remember, I did actually spend $30 buying a point for an antelope hunt in Wyoming.
Oh yeah.
Which means I might, you know, he says if I have one point in that kind of point system of Wyoming, I have about a 50-50 chance of drawing a tag this year. And then if I don't get one this year, I'm almost assured of getting one in the fall of 2022.
Okay.
So yeah, I thought, I mean, he really inspired me to give that a chance to get, you know, to make that after my less than successful elk hunt in Colorado a year ago. He said, if you want to try a stalk hunt in out west, he said, you know, try antelope in Wyoming. So yeah, I took his advice.
Well, that's okay. That's pretty cool. Now, I mean, since you know, I'm the amateur here, that just makes me think a little bit, or think twice about bow hunting. Just the humaneness. You really have to be really good in order to make it a clean process. Because, as you mentioned, I mean, you say it's not terribly uncommon that you'll find remnants of somebody that hit it before, and you know, obviously didn't get it. So just to me, I have a whole new opinion, not opinion, but my eyes have been opened up to how difficult bow hunting must actually be.
Like, yeah, I think it is. And I, you know, it's something I do want to get into, but again, to reference back to an earlier podcast episode we did with Nate Pyle, he talked about how much time he spends practicing.
Okay.
And I, you know, I would really need to do that. I probably, with my rifle, I probably go out twice a year in the summer and practice shooting my rifle at 50 yards, 100 yards, whatever, 125 yards. I go out with my shotgun almost every weekend. We shoot clays up north. But man, if I started bow hunting, which, you know, like I say, I hope to do, yep, it would be quite a commitment to get out there and really get good at it, because it's a lot easier to lose an animal. And you spend a lot more time sitting. Well, hey, let's talk about your first ever hunt. I should say we did talk about it a little bit on the Flush podcast. I really encourage all of our listeners to go listen to The Flush, especially the episode in which I was the subject of the interview. It was a ton of fun. But you and I went out with a few other guys on a Sunday about a month ago. And, I mean, spoiler alert, we did not shoot any pheasant roosters. We did see a couple from a distance. It was it was kind of a rough day of hunting, but nevertheless, like, what'd you think? Was it fun? Was it too cold? What did you like carrying a gun around in a field? Did it make you nervous? Like, what was your experience of it?
So yeah, it was a combination of everything. I overall had a fun time. I really did. It's learning a new craft. It's also giving me another excuse to be outside and actually have a reason to be out there and doing something, which is what it takes sometimes just to get outside. So it was really great on that aspect. I like just, you know, there's almost that camaraderie, that bonding bit too, that happens when you're all out there, you know, in between or whatever. So that was cool too. Was it too cold? No. It was good. I did get nervous holding a gun. I'm not going to lie. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, at points is, you know, I'm making sure my finger's nowhere near the trigger. The trigger's nowhere near something that could bump something, or making sure my gun's upright. Nobody's in the direction where it could be angled. You know, it was a lot to think about at first, but I got more comfortable with it, you know, especially by like the second field we did, where, you know, I walked the first field, felt fine, you know, walked through a lot of different terrain, which is cool. But yeah, you know, I got more comfortable with the idea of it. And then there was one point when one of the dogs pointed a little bit, and that's when I got nervous again. Like, all right, now there's a possibility I might have to shoot. Where is everybody around me? Where is the dog at? So then it got my mind working again. You know, there's really a lot of things working to make this one task happen. So, you know, it's a good worry though, because it keeps you on your toes and you really do learn from the situation when you're a little bit scared of it. So yeah, it was a lot of fun. I really did have a good time. You know, got to see a couple, like you said, from far away, one running across the road to get onto private property.
Right.
But yeah, it was a good day overall. I enjoyed it.
That's cool. Yeah. You know, there's Aristotle. He was a bit critical of Plato in Plato's breakdown of different types of knowledge. Plato talked about theoria and techne, from which we get the words theory and technology. Or, you know, there's also a word praxis, which is more like making stuff work. So obviously theoria is the type of knowledge that's purely in your head. It's the kind of knowledge that Plato and his teacher Socrates said were the greatest kinds of knowledge. And then there's, you know, Plato said, then he kind of looked down his nose at techne, which is this technical knowledge, just basically how to make things work. You know, in other words, Plato thinks it's more noble to be a philosopher than to be a blacksmith, because blacksmiths just mindlessly, you know, pound out horseshoes all day, and a philosopher sits around thinking about truth and the nature of the universe. Aristotle, who broke away from Plato, was critical of this and said there's another kind of knowledge. It's called phronesis, and we don't actually have an English word that comes directly from phronesis, unfortunately, because Plato has been dominant in the West for a long, long time. But I mean, the closest, sometimes it's translated prudence, prudential kind of wisdom, but that's not quite right. Phronesis is the combination of kind of book learning or theoretical knowledge along with practical wisdom of like kind of on the job training. And the reason I say that is because I think your experience, just in the way you describe it, reminds me of something about hunting. It's not unlike learning to drive a car, which I've now been through in the last few years with all three of my kids as they've turned 15 and then 16, getting their learner's permit and then getting their driver's license. And, you know, they go through all this, they go through the 30 hours in the classroom, and they have the behind the wheel training sessions, and they take the written test and get their permit. But then, you know, you have to learn it, it, as you know, from driving, like, it doesn't matter how much you learn about when you turn on your blinker. There's an internal knowledge that happens that now sometimes if you turn on your blinker too early and it's blinking for too long, you feel like, oh, that was kind of, I feel like kind of a goon, you know, or if you forget to turn on your blinker, and somebody beeps their horn at you, again, you feel like a goon.
Right.
It becomes kind of a muscle memory type thing. You just use your blinker, or you don't do what they taught you in driver's ed, where you're on the highway behind somebody and you count 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, but, you know, so you have time to brake or whatever. You internalize it basically. This is exactly, I think, how hunting works, particularly like a bird hunt, like a pheasant hunt. Your first time out there, you know, you have read about it or watched YouTube videos, and you've taken a hunter safety course. And we, of course, did a little gun safety spiel in the, you know, in the driveway before we headed out. But until you get out there and do it, you're always going to be trying to think like, okay, where's the guy on my left? Where's the guy on my right? You know, is my safety on or off? Where's my shooting zone, et cetera. But the more you do it, the more you're going to internalize that knowledge, and it's going to be just a part of who you are. There's another famous philosopher from the 20th century named Pierre Bourdieu. He coined a term for it called habitus. It's almost like a habit, but it's not a mindless habit. It's a habit that you're also thinking about. And so anyway, a long explanation to say that I think that, you know, as you became more comfortable with it, and the more you do it, the more and more comfortable you will be with it, because you know, things are you know, things fall into place and you have more experience. And so you build on your book learning with your practical experience of the endeavor, and it's just going to make you better and better at it and more comfortable at it.
Yeah. It's kind of like the old book smarts versus street smarts, right?
You know, it's
that old sort of bit where that street smarts is, you know, you're going to be scared or whatever, but then instinct is going to kind of take over. Then things become sort of a natural progression from there. You can learn everything you want in the book about anything, but until you actually put, you know, into a practical application, you know, that knowledge is almost useless. It's just there. So no, right, hey, I've gone on hikes before. I love to all the time. So, you know, I thought, hey, hiking through fields, big deal. Super easy. Yeah. No problem. It's just fields. Again, I could read ahead. I could prepare myself, but until I got into the actual fields hunting, that's a different type of walking. That's a different type of exercise that my body has not experienced before, maybe in a very long time. So it's again, you know, I could read ahead as much as I want to, you know, get the right boots, get the right snow pants, get the right everything. Mm-hmm. But until I'm actually out in the field and practicing these things that I've quote unquote learned, that knowledge meant nothing beforehand. I learned everything completely different when I was out there in the field doing it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, I work harder walking through fields when I'm hunting than I ever would if I were just on a hike, because I have a goal, you know, like I have a what the Greeks called a telos. I have something that I'm aiming toward, and that is to, you know, quarry an animal. And yeah, if I were just out on a hike, for one thing, you know, when you're hiking, most of the time you're on a trail that other people have hiked on. You're very seldom are you bushwhacking,
right?
Like through a forest or through a field. And when you're hunting, it's almost all bushwhacking. Now, some of it's pretty easy walking in knee high switchgrass or something. But a lot of times it's like we're pushing through cattails. It's muddy or snowy. It's super hard work. And I push myself as a 52-year-old, I push myself a lot harder hunting than I do when I go to the gym, just to be totally honest. You know,
well, I mean, it's well, and you're doing the physical task too of this harder, a little bit extra work, but then your mind is also working on looking at the ground, seeing if there's any sign of anything around, making sure you're not stepping anything, all the while looking forward, seeing where the dog's at. It's a there's a lot going on at one time.
There's a lot going on, and you have a deadly weapon in your hands.
Yes, so you very much do.
It just forces you to be alert in a way that a lot of other. I mean, look, it's a common kind of thought about modern life is things are so easy that it lulls us into a malaise, you know, we're all kind of zombies because nothing is that difficult. We get, you know, so bored sitting at a stoplight, we open our phone and check Twitter because we're just sleepwalking through life. And hunting in so many ways makes demands on us, and having this lethal weapon in our hands is a big part of it. It makes demands on us that we become more attentive to what's going on around us. And yeah, I love that. I mean, you said it that day, you said it on the Flush podcast, you said it again here. I love hearing that. I love hearing you say that because it's a reminder to me. I'll never again be a first time hunter. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
So for you to say that, like, oh my gosh, I'm thinking about where do I aim my gun? And you know, these guys around me, they have guns and this and that. I like hearing that because it reminds me of what we're doing and what it's like. So,
well, and man, it's such a different way of learning anything these days. You know, instead of doing it on a touch screen, something that fits in my palm, I'm actually having to go out there and use some critical thinking and physical. I'm having to be physical about it too at the same time. So, in a weird way, you know, it gives respect for the people of the past and like how they had to learn and actually do stuff. Whereas, like you said, we get bored at a stoplight because we have an extra 5 seconds. You know, it's a slow learning process too, and it's painful physically at points, and mentally it can be a little bit strenuous because it's a slower, longer process. But I do feel you gain so much more in that regard, and you know that respect level you're about. When I finally get to see an animal, will be even that much more just knowing what you have to go through to get to that point.
Well, winter, do you think you and I could get out sometime in December?
Yeah, absolutely. I have healed up from my physical ailment. I think I'm almost 100%, so I'm ready to go.
Good.
Yeah.
Let's do it. I'm headed to, I'll just, when this airs, I'll just be back from South Dakota. But let's make sure we get out there. And I think if we go on a weekday, we might have a little bit better luck. We might also go right after it snows. And that just makes it so great for the dogs to be able to pick up scent laying on top of the snow from the birds, you know. So what we'll try to do is set it up, and then maybe Travis can give us one of his super secret spots and tell us where to go to find. He's got like the fast track and the pheasants forever. He can tell us where to go.
Yeah, he does. He's got connections and he knows how to use them correctly.
Yeah.
And I will definitely open up a day. I mean, you know, not to talk too soon, but I can definitely open up a day midweek so we can do this. Where
all right, all right.
Have a solid
now. Before we go, what did you have on Thursday for Thanksgiving dinner?
I had probably Chinese takeout from a local place right across the street from me.
Oh my gosh, are you like in a Christmas story or something?
it's my version of the Thanksgiving story. There's only a couple places open on Thanksgiving. It's only going to be me and my girlfriend. There's no sense in making this huge extravagant
turkey
meal. We'll just right. Have some Chinese food with leftovers later. I mean, it's okay.
Good. Oh man, that sounds pretty good actually.
Yeah, it could be worth. And it's supporting a local business that everybody needs to do a little right now.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's very true. I'm gonna be trying my first turkey on the rotisserie. I've done some ducks on my Weber kettle grill rotisserie attachment. I've done a couple ducks and some chickens. This will be my first turkey. So I'm looking forward to seeing how that turns out.
Well, I wish you luck, and I look forward to seeing the Instagram pictures that are that will soon be following, I imagine.
Oh, yeah, there'll be Insta. There'll be Insta, at the Reverend Hunter. Well, before we go, I do just want to say to listeners out there, we got here another month of the year, but I've just so appreciated the support we've gotten in the first year of this podcast. I cannot tell you how important it is in the kind of podcast universe to get ratings and reviews and subscriptions. Like, the more of those we get, the more it helps us out there serving up, you know, first of all, the different podcast services will recommend this podcast to people who listen to similar podcasts. But man, a lot of people, you know, they scroll through and look at how many reviews the show has and what the average star rating is and what people say in the comments. So all I want for Christmas is just that you take 15 seconds to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. I'd really, really appreciate it.
Yeah. Oh, and tell a friend, because word of mouth when it comes to these podcasts is probably one of the best ways you can really get it out there. If you like it, if you relate to it or anything, tell a friend. I mean, why not?
Yeah, man. You can share it with a one tap. You can share it with somebody. So please do it. Well, thanks everybody for listening to the Reverend Hunter podcast, this special fifth Monday episode, Once in a Blue Moon. Brandon and I just chit-chat, the two of us. We appreciate you listening in. And we will be back next week with another episode of the Reverend Hunter podcast.
These lakes hold a lot of stories, and all of them get better every time they're told. Because you've got 40-inch gators out there, giant lakers, crappies, sunnies, and walleye. So many walleye. So get ready with the best from clam, otter, vexlar, hummingbird, garmin, 13 fishing, and many more. The Shields Ice Fishing Sale runs now through December 13th, in-store and online at shields.com. The ice is calling.